Welcome, everyone, to another episode of our second season of Story Trek. I'm your co-captain, Michael Strategakis.
I'm Marshall Hopkins.
Today, we've decided that since we're honoring Star Trek Day, September 8th, 2021, the 55th anniversary of the show that we also love, that we've decided to talk about the way that the fan community and fandom in general have influenced what we see and hear and experience in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, fandom has been not only a huge part of Star Trek, it's been a part of the fabric of it from early on, very early on. In addition to that, Star Trek, I would argue, and I believe there is a GQ article by Molly McArdle that would argue that Star Trek invented fandom as we know it.
Really? So,
yeah, it's a GQ article, Molly McArdle, September 2016. You can go read it. But basically, she breaks down how there may have been fan letter writing campaigns to save a show here or there before, but nothing with the impact that Star Trek had. Like, it literally succeeded. And then it spawned an entire culture, which you, our listeners, and us obviously are a part of.
I think our listeners also might have some more additional insight into this, but I seem to recall that before the Star Trek fandom existed, you really just had fandoms of genres, fandoms of artists or authors. There wasn't a specific fandom of a series. That said, I would say that there was a fandom, or at least followers of the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes novellas, mm-hmm. short stories. Mm-hmm. You've certainly had the followers of magazines of pulp fiction, mm-hmm. as well as science fiction of the 1950s and even the 60s. And, I mean, Trek was also even premiered at a science fiction convention in the 1960s. It was the first time it was actually shown to the public. But as far as like the mainstay of pop culture today, the way that we see it, it is, I would argue, as I guess this article does as well, that it is the first.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have no problem citing my source and quoting directly from it, literally saying the franchise created the template for fandom, transformed sleepy science fiction get-togethers into celebrity-driven media events, pioneered the licensed merchandising operations that make tentpole movies from Star Wars to Spider-Man possible, and anticipated, even inspired, the creation of future technologies. Star Trek invented nerd culture as we know it today, and that nerd culture, this is the unquote from Molly McArdle, and then my addition is that nerd culture also saves Star Trek and has influenced the flow of its stories, the changes over time.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, we talked about it in one of our previous podcasts, how Star Trek, you know, deals with resurrections, so to speak, and death. How Trek has been dead many times in its own existence. And that is, by and large, a factor of the fandom reaching back and pulling it away from sort of, you know, the grave, if you will.
And not just pulling it back from the grave, pulling characters back from the grave, just to take you back on the resurrection point. And I just remembered this. I don't know why I didn't bring it up during that podcast. A very good friend of mine, I've known him since high school, he once told me that his mother was a part of the "if you don't bring Spock back to life, we're quitting Star Trek" letter writing campaign.
Oh, yeah. So that was actually interesting. As I recall, that was a situation where Gene Roddenberry actually leaked that Spock was being killed. It was a little matter of contention between him and the studio and Harv Bennett at the time, just feeling like at that time that was the first. That's the first Trek where Gene was pushed away from Trek itself. That was the first time with Wrath of Khan. Mm-hmm. As you may recall, he voluntarily kind of stepped away for the third season of the original series in the 60s. And then, of course, with the motion picture, he was the full-on producer of the movie. But after the reactions to the motion picture were out, the studio decided to take a different direction, leaving Gene with the honorary title of executive consultant.
Right, which was not dissimilar from just like the empty title of, you know, chairman emeritus or something like that.
Exactly. But there is something to be said about the recognition that, you know, with that you just brought up, that there was an understanding in the fact that that was leaked and there was the whole campaign that that was part of, that the fans had an active role in the creation of Star Trek. If you go back to the 1960s, in fact, there were several people who were writers, especially in particularly in the third season, if I recall. I don't remember names of writers offhand, but there were writers for the original series that were fans. These were fans whose material got in the hands of Mr. Roddenberry, and he liked their work enough to, or one of his producing team partners, to develop it further for an episode of the show. I believe one of the episodes was The Empath, for instance. I believe David Gerald was a young fellow when he wrote The Trouble with Tribbles. I'm not sure if he was a fan of the show or he just wrote it to write it as a young writer out of UCLA.
Right.
But that's an example of somebody who just kind of fell into Star Trek as a writer for the first time.
That's fascinating. And, you know, I know I'm taking a brief aside here, but as we're mentioning the writers of Star Trek, I just had a thought as I was watching some episodes of the original series, and we'd be remiss if we didn't touch upon, and we may go elaborate later, on some of the negative aspects of fandom. Specifically, I was thinking about how there's so much misogyny that's directed at Trek, has always been directed at Trek, and no less so now, particularly at shows like Discovery, what we see on Picard, things like that. And it galls me that to think that these people are honoring a show that was partly contributed to by so many women writers. I really have to question their fandom if they don't realize that the D of DC Fontana stands for Dorothy.
Right. And yeah, she was the first, but she certainly was not the last female writer on Trek. In fact, I think that writer I was mentioning, the fan writer from the 60s, I believe was a woman as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's you have so few things in media and entertainment that not only project progressivism, and of course they sometimes fail at it, but aspire to progressivism both in front of and behind the camera. That seems like that's always been a part of the production crew of Star Trek, but that aspect has also led to the fandom, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody from early on felt like they could be a part of Star Trek.
I mean, you even go back to sort of the first fan in the letter writing campaign to save Star Trek in the 1960s. That was led by a couple, and specifically Bijo Tremble, again, a woman, mm-hmm. who led the letter writing campaign to save Star Trek. So both as a fan and as a writer for the show, women have had a role in Trek from the beginning, mm-hmm. albeit it's not the equality that we'd strive for today. To eliminate or to look past that would be a mistake.
Right. Just to drop another name, Jacqueline Lichtenberg founded the Star Trek Well Committee, which introduced new fans to the community.
Yeah.
So there were so many people who shepherded and were truly the founders and sort of godparents of the fandom that we know today that has both expanded. It's difficult to think about all the many ways that Star Trek has expanded beyond just a simple TV show shot on backlots in the 1960s.
I was going to say, one of the things, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the fan writing campaigns, the influence that that had. As far as people writing for the show, if you get to the 1980s, we have more official open submission policy that was championed by Michael Piller in the late 80s and early 90s that led to a lot of fans taking advantage of this open policy, this official open policy that said, hey, if you want to, with these guidelines, you can write for Star Trek. I have a copy of actually one of the headers of one of those letters. Maybe we can share it on our social, maybe on Facebook.
Oh, wow.
And so you can kind of get a sense. This was an official policy. This wasn't something that was like in a back room or like, hey, you know, if you want to submit for Star Trek, you know, give so-and-so the script. No, it was an official policy of the show.
Appeared to be totally meritorious. If you had a great script, they would contact you back.
That's right. They had as I understand it, they had a reader or a team of readers whose responsibility it was to skim through the scripts and read through them and find which ones were worth conversations beyond just a rejection letter. And everybody on the screenwriting staff for TNG was at one point responsible for combing through some of the more selective scripts and seeing if there was anything that they could glean from them, whether or not they wanted to bring the writer in and see what else they had, whether or not they're like, hey, this writer's pretty good, but the script itself is not so great. I mean, there was a lot of different ways. And by and large, it's people like Ronald Moore, who were fans, who got their first opportunity writing for Trek because of this policy, because of open submissions. And, it's not that somebody, I'm bringing up Ron Moore as an example specifically because he's one of several of the writers who came in as a Trek fan and left after their experience with Trek to become showrunners, executive producers for other well-known television series out there. If I'm not mistaken, not just Ronald Moore, but you're looking at Brandon Braga.
I was actually going to ask you, like, how many different creators did that policy yield? Like, as you mentioned, Ronald Moore, Brian Fuller, and in addition to that, Niren Shankar, who wrote for TNG, is now the executive producer of The Expanse.
Yeah. Was Brian Fuller part of the open submission policy?
I think he was.
I'm not sure of when that open submission policy died. I don't know if it died at some point under Berman, but I definitely know it was existing for the 7 years of TNG's run. So I assume it, seventh season of TNG, they weren't pulling from the pile as much as they were possibly looking at writers for maybe Deep Space Nine. But again, if it'd be a great thing, maybe someday we can get someone who was part of that writing that era of screenwriting at Trek to confirm whether or not that open policy was actually in effect at that time. There's several other writers who later came to Trek. And like we're saying, there's a likelihood that this program continued for a lot of the 90s run of Trek. But one other thing I think we'd be remiss in talking about is actually an era of Trek where there was no Trek, and that's the 1970s, because that's the time that we actually open up a completely fresh and new and sometimes bizarre part of Trek history, which is the fan fiction.
Oh, yeah.
And we get all kinds of stuff that's good, stuff that's bad, stuff that, well, just makes you really want to cringe that someone tried to insert Trek into it. For better or worse, there's some entertaining things that are a part of it, but it's hard to talk about Trek today without that period because that was actually at the same time a period of fans filling in the gaps for a lot of characters and filling in, and it led to, what eventually became the line of Star Trek novels and comics that came afterwards, that they needed a larger bit of common knowledge, common bits of information. And there was fan fiction that spawned certain bits of information about characters. Anything from, if I'm not mistaken, Hikaru Sulu originally came from fan fiction. I think, where was the Tiberius for T for Kirk out of that, or was that, or am I imagining it?
I'm not sure. I can look that up. I'm pretty sure that Nyota,
Yep.
who was first name, I think that that was fan fiction.
Yeah, I'm 90% sure about that too.
Let me look
And
that
that
up.
was all in the 70s era of Trek. It wasn't something that was spawned, later down the road. And it was fans who wanted to fill in these gaps. It's a period where we got a lot of erotic fiction with Trek.
The slash fiction, yes. And
Yes.
some people can find it cringe, and frankly, it can get very much into the territory of cringe. At the same time, I think that it's worth mentioning that for a lot of LGBTQIA audiences, there is such a desperate desire to see themselves reflected in media, especially in the 1970s. This is the beginning of the gay rights movement. Not the beginning, but this is the nascent years, the early days of the gay rights movement. So the concept of being yourself and having these things and being able to even write these stories openly and share them with others is pretty new and pretty fresh. So the idea that they would want to codify Kirk and Spock or various other pairings in relationships, again, it depends on your comfort with sexuality, and that's fine. But I think that it is done with a kind of love for these characters in a sense. It's not done derisively or degrading of them. As a matter of fact, it's because they see themselves so much in characters like Spock or Kirk that they wanted to go that extra mile and have that character more emulate them, as anybody who watches fantasy wants to do.
And it's interesting because in some ways it's like Star Trek is science fiction, and in many ways the fan fiction takes that science fiction into the world of fantasy. But I think, when you get to like the 1980s, late 70s and the 80s now then you get into the era of, more fan letters, you get into the convention circuits, you even have merchandising driving Trek. And the merchandising has actually been a significant player in Trek storylines for on occasion. If you go back to the 1960s and the third season of the original series, there's the episode "In Truth Is There No Beauty," and in that episode is the introduction of the Itik symbol, and that was actually a bit of controversy between Leonard Nimoy and Gene Roddenberry, as I understand it. Gene was at this point seeing that Trek was on the way out, or was wanting to make an extra buck, and he had designed this symbol as a piece of jewelry to sell. And in a need to make it code in Trek to make it more valid, if you will, he wrote into the episode, or insisted upon in that episode, that there be a scene about the Itik and that Spock would wear it. I think, and again, just from what I've read and understood, it has a lot to do also with Nimoy not wanting to basically be product placement, and felt it was out of place, not from a place of character, but as a place of show versus product placement. Which, of course, nowadays product placement is so ubiquitous to television and film that we hardly think twice about something like that. That seems rather mild in comparison. I mean, you could even go back again. I keep going back to the 1960s. I guess it's because we're talking about Star Trek Day today, and it's 55 years ago, but when they were originally trying to drum up ratings for the original series, they had Shatner and Nimoy on a float in the Pasadena New Year's parade,
Oh my.
the Rose Bowl parade. And I think there's some photos out there of showing, and I'm sure it wasn't just one location, one instance, but Leonard Nimoy was often flying on weekends to different parts of the country dressed up as Mr. Spock. I don't know if someone was there to put his makeup on or not, but I just have this weird imagination that someone at Desilu Studios put him in makeup and sent him on a plane, and he flew wherever with pointed ears.
On the one hand, that's awesome. On the other hand, I can't imagine how he felt walking through an airport full of people and sitting on a plane dressed up in full Mr. Spock costume.
I'm sure there that it wasn't so blatant. I can't imagine it being like he's in a blue top with a wig and ears. I'm sure he had a hat on and wore something else or
Okay.
something, at least that. I can't imagine that the ears were as he goes boards the plane. I know security was not the same as it is today, which would have been absolutely hilarious. You imagine if they had like 9/11 style security back in the 1960s. Nimoy's going through with wearing pointed ears at a time no one knows what Trek is, and just
Actually, there were so many allusions to the pointed ears being resembling of the devil. Yeah, that would
right,
not have worked well.
or especially going to the South, which
Oh, yeah.
I could just imagine what that would have been like. So I'm not saying that he did fly that way. I'm just speculating that I know that perhaps he did travel to some extent in costume, in makeup, and that perhaps that at least elicited a raised eyebrow, pardon the term. But it was true that he did fly all over the country in promotion of Star Trek, and specifically of Mr. Spock.
That is an incredible story. I mean, of course, I wasn't alive then, but I'm that kid who would have been pointing at him and was like, "It's Mr. Spock." So we've got to mention one time that, of course, Star Trek had a big issue with fan reaction, and that is the interracial kiss. That was in the episode, I believe it was Plato's Stepchildren.
That's the one.
And of course, there were obviously concerns. This is a famous story that you probably already know. Well, there was a great deal of concern over the syndication stations dropping the show throughout the South over it being an interracial kiss. Now, here's the thing is that it turns out that it didn't kick up as much fuss when aired as they thought it would. People actually wound up accepting it. Here's the kind of the interesting thing where people try to predict the fan response, and then the fan response is nothing at all that they expect, that they thought it would be. I found that interesting just because, and this is the era, and this is again a part of the fandom of Trek, where fans seize power over the media that they're watching. And I think that that's one significant point, because prior to this, it was whatever show we think is going to sell, either it sticks to the wall or it doesn't. That felt like it was kind of the view of 1950s television. And then you have innovators like Roddenberry and Rod Serling who come along and change things, and it changes the way fans interact with television. So I bring all this up just to say, I think that this is the era where, again, quoting that GQ article, not only does fandom begin or grow, but it immediately seizes some agency. You know, it isn't just a studio product. This isn't, you know, it no longer just belonged even to Roddenberry. It was part of the fans, to the point that when the network said there's no more Star Trek, the fans said, yes, there is.
And still it wasn't enough right before the Apollo moon landing that Star Trek was now officially off the air.
As a sidebar, I do wish I could see what Star Trek, you know, season four, 1969 and 1970 would have looked like. I'm sure the sideburns and mustaches would have been ridiculous.
I wonder how soon we would have gotten McCoy in that amazing jumpsuit, or Scotty with the mustache.
I just hope Star Trek would never go mod. That's not a style they can fit.
You know, one thing that struck me about the Plato stepchildren controversy, if you will, is that they were prompted to actually create that episode and to add that moment to the story, because as I understand it, the show was at that point, it was living on Friday nights and the ratings were bad. And the showrunner at the time, not Roddenberry, Fred Freiberger, wanted to push things a little bit further with the envelope that season, because as he was realizing, we don't have anyone really watching the show right now, so we're going to take some risks. And that's where the idea was for the interracial kiss, as I understand it, was a chance to drum up controversy / ratings. And it was controversial in the fact that some people thought, as you well pointed out, that the South would reject a syndicated show. There's also the line of thought that the reason that there wasn't any pushback was a testament to how dead of a time Star Trek was at. And right. No one was watching it enough to raise an eyebrow unless you were a loyal, dedicated fan. So it's really a question of who was watching, and we have no idea. it is obviously part of television history and American history in a certain degree. You know, that was, you know, the fans did allow Trek to get to that third season that would not exist. And, you know, when we get to the era of the internet, one of the first times you get news groups, chat groups, use groups, whatever, what do you call it? Chat groups?
Chat rooms.
Chat rooms, exactly. I can't remember here. That era so long ago. You know, you get these fan newsletters online, and newsletters that used to be mailed to people's homes for fans. Now it's becoming more real time in the fact that you can post something and a minute later somebody can respond to it. So you get this whole like blog vlog conversation going with Trek fans where they're now reacting to episodes. And you see something for the first time in the 90s, particularly with DS9 and Voyager, and then into Enterprise, where you're not, you know, Star Trek as a fan, as creators of the shows, they're not waiting to go to a convention to have a fan stand up and ask a question that gives them some insight into fan reaction to something. They're not waiting to get a letter in the mail like they used to, like a month and a half after the episode aired.
Right.
You know, they're finding out that night, like after the episode's aired, that, hey, this moment between these two characters was amazing, or this thing totally sucked. And it was this more instant reaction that not just writers for Trek, but writers I know in particular for the X-Files were also very keen to look at, to understand what that fan base's reaction was to the show at the initial airing of it.
And just thinking about that, you know, if when Deep Space Nine premiered and the internet existed then as it does now, I'm not sure if that show would have gotten seven seasons. Because if you recall, it was a slow a period of time before a lot of people began accepting a Star Trek show where you didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, I think that I think people out of habit and desire for something with the word Star Trek on it were tuning in to Deep Space Nine at the time. And as much as I love the show, I'm also very aware of that era and my own reaction to the concept of Deep Space Nine at the time. To know that, it wasn't an accepted show. It just wasn't. And we could go on and on about those reasons, but yeah, I think the way that today, especially with blogs and vlogs and YouTube reviews and, whatever else you have on the internet and Twitter, I think you're right. There's not, it would be very difficult for Deep Space Nine to have gone seven seasons as it did. I mean, it has the second most number of aired released episodes of any Trek.
Wow.
Two fewer than TNG.
I did not know that.
So it's more than Voyager, but less than TNG. And a lot of times it's just kind of interesting to me that, yeah, that show would not have survived. It survived because our media at the time was not as fragmented as it is today. It survived because this was the first Trek outside of sort of the Gene Roddenberry Trek bubble. And I think people would tune in enough on occasion to see what the show was. And I mean, it did have the overlap with TNG for the first two seasons, which were honestly the rougher two seasons of the show. At least it had the tailwind of airing right after TNG. So you'd finish that episode of that show that you really loved in season six and seven of it, and right behind it was season one, season two of this new Trek that you maybe you weren't so sure on. Maybe you kept it on a little bit longer than you would have had you then decided in the middle of the episode, like, I'm not feeling so good about this show. I'm not really sure about this show. Let me see what people are saying on Twitter. Oh, no one else likes it either. Click. I think that's probably a big part of how we consume, like my view of how we consume media today is we form our opinions, we form our reactions, and then we kind of check our reactions to see whether or not we think they're valid within the zeitgeist of the audience that see ourselves belonging to.
Right, and sometimes you just find yourself as a bitter contrarian.
Yeah, you're the person who goes on to the blog or the vlog. I guess it'd be the blog. I guess your reactions could also be on YouTube vlogs. So
Logs.
they're all logs. Captain's log, right? Captain's vlog. I'm surprised we don't have Captain's vlogs yet. Why not?
Well, we just named our YouTube
Captain's vlog. Anyway, I can't believe. So come on, someone has to have taken that.
It's got to be taken. No way. There's no way nobody's thought of that.
Sir, the only captain's vlog is a yacht.
Are you kidding
It's
me?
a luxury yachting thing called Captain's Vlog. It's just a YouTube channel thing called Captain's Vlog, and it's about following along on a super yacht. For anybody who's keeping track of this, we just had to check this out.
That's talk about wasting prime real estate.
Yes, you could have had a captain's vlog. I'm sure.
So, just to kind of get us back to fandom, I mean, there's so many different places we could go to talk about how the fact that fandom has literally created a new language, Klingon. Like, this would not have existed if it were not for fans. Not just fans keeping the show alive, but literally it was a fan who was a linguist,
Mark Okrand.
Mark Okrand, who created an entire Klingon language. And then Ronald D. Moore created a culture to go with it.
And now you can go to the annual Klingon language camp, I believe, in Chicago, Illinois. I don't have the website in front of me or anything like that, but you can Google it and attend the Klingon camp. I have looked at the website before and can tell you that it's not a place to cosplay. They take their language learning quite seriously. So do not be expecting to drink a lot of, blood wine or Ractigino for that matter. I think you're there to actually learn the Klingon language as you would any other language.
They take it deeply seriously, as surely as you're learning like any Asian language or Latin language or anything like that.
It's quite remarkable that a show has inspired people enough to actually build that language out to the point that, as much as Star Trek has changed between the, as people call the old Trek versus new Trek, the JJ, the post JJ Abrams era, that even in the JJ movies where there is Klingon, it is based on that same Klingon language. It's not that, you know, someone said, I don't like that language, let's come up with our own little sounds and things like that. It's been the same Klingon language. Now, there's been pronunciation differences, don't get me wrong, with Discovery, for instance. And I don't know if that's so much of that is due to just ideas of expanding the language, or if it's just ideas, it has to do with the prosthetics and teeth that are in the actors' mouths and what they could pronounce.
They really should have talked to Armin Shimerman about that.
Oh, humans.
But yeah, and again, I just to make that distinction, because I know there are going to be people out there who will say, well, Tolkien created Elvish, and I'm like, well, yes, that's the creator who intended to create this language. This was not sourced from people who were just fans of it. Now, I'm sure that there are many Tolkien experts out there who are, if I'm incorrect, feel free to let me know. But again, the Elvish language was a concept created by Tolkien himself.
I think it actually even goes further in that Tolkien was so keen on creating the Elvish language that he actually wrote Lord of the Rings to give it to give it a context to which it belonged to.
Right, thank you. Like the language came first, the story came second.
Yeah, I want to build a language. I want to world build a language. Well, you can't really build a fake language like that. Well, what if I make it part of a fake story? Okay. So I'm going to write the most famous fantasy novel series of all time in order to utilize a fake language.
Now, on the other hand, again, you have fans who are not just fans of the story, they're contributing to the story, how it goes, how it changes, how it flows, right? Because if we did not have the Klingon language constructed the way Mark Ockren did, that was a huge influencer in many ways to the way Ronald D. Moore established the Klingon culture in episodes of TNG and DS9.
I mean, we even more so about the sort of the enthusiasm of fans. I mean, you have fan film, not just the fan fiction that was on the page, but you actually have film stuff. Now, that's obviously been a lot of controversy over the last few years, and I'm not really going to take any sides about it at this time. But the thing to point out is it has had an effect on not just fan perceptions of certain eras of Trek history and Trek lore, but also certain perceptions or raising profiles for some of the actors who have been part of Trek. You have George Takei coming in a role on Star Trek fan films, and Walter Koenig, the gentleman, I can't remember the name right here, the guy who played Apollo was in an episode where he reprised the role.
And I know the William Wyndham, he reprised his role as Commodore Decker, somehow miraculously having survived the Doomsday Machine.
Yes, and then we get a lot of that fan fiction where we resurrect characters just in order to tie into things, and whether or not it's successful, that's for you to decide. The big thing to also point out with these fan films is that sometimes I wonder if perhaps their dedication to canon, if you will, or what perceived notions of canon, as we've discussed, is part of the reason that there are positive and negative reactions to how the actual shows work with canon. For instance, the sets from the original series, there are fan films that use the original blueprints from the original series for their sets. So everything is a one-to-one match for the show as it appeared in the 60s. Now, is that something that, you know, the creators of New Trek would do? Probably not. I seriously doubt it. But would they, you know, would they maybe take some of their cues from the fans, understanding like what things fans really latched onto from those designs and styles? Sure, why not? Every fan base does.
Of course. Yeah, I think that for me, and again, I've watched some of these fan films, and they're the work of a lot of people who are doing a labor of love. That said, to the point that you made a second ago, I think that for a lot of the fans, the dichotomy in terms of canon is whether or not that story that we're watching, this fan film, feels like it could fit into canon, right? I feel like Star Trek fans, more than most other fandoms, expect whatever content there is to all be a part of this larger, great story of this galaxy. As opposed to, you can have a completely random aside thing in Star Wars. You don't necessarily need to know what era in time it is. You don't necessarily need to know, if this is before the Empire or after the Empire or anything like that. So long as you have certain key imageries that are familiar with Star Wars, you get that it's Star Wars and you can kind of go along with it, even if it's not a part of the greater saga. With Star Trek, I feel like there are certain fan films that have been very popular, and they're very popular because they find a niche within canon that they can fulfill. And I think that people gravitate towards that because Star Trek fans, like I said, I think that they're more part of the greater story rather than this is a universe where any story can be told. And that's not to say we always have to follow the Enterprise, as Deep Space Nine proved, as Voyager proved, as many other shows have proved. But again, all of these stories take place within the context of that galaxy. So I think that that's the dividing line for fandom, is that just like the Klingon language, just like Uhura's first name, Nyota, just like Hikaru Sulu and Tiberius, so many things that fans contributed and added to the story and added to that world. I'm just thankful that not a lot of slash has been the things that have been added into that world.
Well, one of the things that's interesting, and it's sort of a Venn diagram, what do you call it? When the Venn diagram overlaps, was the word I'm
Yeah,
looking
that's a van.
for. You have Lower Decks. It's this weird thing that, in so many ways, it could almost seem like it's a fan film, but it's written obviously by a talented led by a showrunner who's a very talented fan of Star Trek. But he's also a professional, he's an established professional television writer in comedy and animation. And he's created this show which lives very much in canon for Trek. But the execution of the show, the style of the show, is radically different to the point that it's something you would expect out of a fan film, that it's just this departure from things. But he's very, it's the show's very keen to stay part of it, to stay part of that Star Trek universe. And in fact, piggybacking on what I had mentioned earlier about how, Star Trek has used product placement and merchandising to sell things from within the show, I think they've taken it to a whole new level with Lower Decks, in the fact that every single week for the first season, I don't know if they're doing this for season two, they were releasing a t-shirt every week that had to do with each episode of the show. Like, there's the famous Choo 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 shirt, which I've seen quite often at conventions and such. And there's also like the commemorative, Tom Paris, Lieutenant Paris, plate that made an appearance. It's a tie-in to the whole merchandising of Trek. And yes, you can order a Tom Paris plate. Now, which came first? The merchandising, or the show placing, creating this idea? I'm not really sure. It's a reflection very much of the idea that the show can be merchandised.
Disclaimer: Tom Paris plate does not actually speak with the voice of Robert Duncan McNeil.
It doesn't.
Well, unless you're, well, see, you haven't seen season two
No,
of
I
Lower Decks,
haven't. I haven't seen it yet.
so I can't discuss it at length.
What I will say is I do know it exists on the online store. You can buy the plate,
Yes.
and I'm sure there's other merchandise for Lower Decks as well this season. I think that Titmouse, the animation company, is responsible for creating a lot of that merchandise, or at least designing it. You can check out, I'm sure, if you're watching the show currently, you can check out to see what merchandise they're tying into the show every week.
Let's take a quick second to think about the future. I mean, this is Trek. What's the future of fandom? Like, what do we think is gonna, and I'm not trying to predict what's gonna happen on Star Trek Day, September 8th. We'll have other opportunities to kind of discuss those in revelations and new news and all the wonderful things. But what are some things we might see out of fandom in the future? You know, I think that a lot of us are eagerly anticipating Strange New Worlds. Do you think that in the eyes of fans that might wind up outshining the other Star Trek series that are on now?
Well, it's really a question of who's watching Trek today. And who's, I mean, when Trek aired originally in the 1960s, you had a television set, you turn on the TV, as long as you are within radio, you know, reception range of an NBC affiliate, Star Trek was able to be seen in your home. You get to the 1990s, and you have local TV stations, and just about every local affiliate had Star Trek. So yes, you got to see Star Trek, to turn on your TV, which was obviously by the 1990s and 80s and 90s, much more ubiquitous than even the 60s. And again, there was Star Trek for you. Now you get to the era of Discovery and later, where Star Trek exists via paid subscription. Now, there have been exceptions where they've released first episodes of the show on YouTube for short periods of time, and people could check those out. They've also had instances where they've aired episodes of Discovery. I believe the entire first season of Discovery aired on CBS last year during the pandemic.
Yes.
And I don't know if that was effective in growing the fan base or getting people to watch Discovery. I haven't heard one way or another if that had any effect on things. But I do know that the streaming services are a bit more complicated when it comes to around the world. So, for instance, Lower Decks didn't get the initial sort of social media vibe around the world in its first season because they didn't have distribution rights overseas for Lower Decks. So Lower Decks would air in the would be released on CBS All Access last year, and you know, people on the fan base would be laughing and talking about a certain moment or instance in the episode or storyline, and people in the UK were going, I have no idea, I can't see Lower Decks.
Right.
So now that that's all been sorted out for the most part and fans have more readily access to it, that, you know, that does keep sort of fan bases on a more synchronized level. But the question really is, how many people are in the age of so many different paid subscription streaming services are going to be popping down their money on Paramount Plus when, quite frankly, I'm not bashful to say this, Paramount Plus still lacks the breadth and volume of content outside of Trek.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm looking to grow the Star Trek fan base, perhaps you're looking to grow the fan base in other ways, maybe through merchandising, maybe through overseas opportunities on broadcast television. I'm not really sure. I don't really know if Paramount Plus is the venue for it because it doesn't really allow the fan base to grow. You have a massive, massive fan base for Star Wars, and you drop it exclusively with The Mandalorian and those shows on Disney Plus. But Disney Plus already has people coming there to watch Marvel. Disney Plus already has people coming there to watch National Geographic or animated Disney film classics. There's already other groups of people coming to Disney Plus to watch other things that can discover The Mandalorian. Now, with Discovery and Picard, how many of those people that are tuning into these things got to these shows when they actually came to this platform for other things? Mm-hmm. That I don't know. I don't think it's that big a group of people. I could be wrong, but I haven't seen any data to prove otherwise. I think it's really a question of how can you really sustain and grow the Trek fan base when you have a platform that doesn't offer opportunities for new fans to find the show. And that's my biggest concern of Trek in the future, is not that the quality of the programming of these shows is better or worse than it has been in the past. It's more a question of audience reach.
And from what I've seen of Paramount Plus, it feels like their hope and goal was for Star Trek to be sort of their Marvel, the thing that people come to watch and then they discover other things, but there isn't much other content despite the, you know, vast library that they no doubt have. You know, you flip through things, but it and, you know, I don't want to badmouth them or anything like that, but it does feel like there's a paucity of options there that fans would like. And I think that their best option would be to like spend some time developing the other franchises they already have in their control. I don't know exactly per se. I think they have the Addams Family franchise.
They do. They also have Mission Impossible.
They have Mission Impossible, right.
The Godfather.
They have The Godfather. You're right. And then, of course, they have the Indiana Jones series. And that's great, but that's, you know, three movies. Yes, I said three movies.
There was a fourth, or was it just planned?
I think that was a fever dream we all had.
I to be honest, I was out of the country the year that was released, and I heard about the reviews, and I was told, and I think that by the time I saw the South Park that lampooned how bad the movie was, I was fairly content to not see the film.
You didn't miss much. But no, to that point, like Paramount has a lot of franchises. I feel like if I'm, you know, one of their, you know, I know these things don't work quite so simply, but I'm saying to myself, like, yes, I want more Star Trek shows, but I also want a Spy Kids show. You know, I want I want an exclusive to Paramount Plus, the Naked Gun reboot, you know, something like that, because, you know, there are opportunities within their franchises, but you have to be able and willing to use something other than Star Trek, because Star Trek is a little bit fragile. The fans can only do so much. It's been canceled before. There was a period recently between, what was it, 2003 and 2009?
You talking about the cancellation of Enterprise?
Right. So between the cancellation of Enterprise and the J.J. Trek movie.
Mm-hmm. That's 2005 to 2009.
5 to 9. So 3 years. In modern media speed, in the modern media cycle, that's an eternity almost, 3 years without any, you know, information or anything new.
Yeah. Not only that, but when you hit the JJ era of Trek, they were so slow between movies. Before Discovery came out, it was almost like it was an eternity between movies. I mean, you go back and look at the 1970s, 80s Trek at the time. It was like 1979, you have Motion Picture. 1981, 1982, Wrath of Khan. It's like these movies, and then, of course, you know, Search for Spock, 84. It's like these movies were coming every 2 years. Then you look at Into Darkness, which was 2012.
Yeah.
And then you don't get Beyond until 4 years later.
Yeah.
4 whole years later, you're like, wait, there's Star Trek? Yeah, there's this thing, Star Trek. And then, of course, it was the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, and I've heard all kinds of explanations for this, but let's be honest, aside from Beyond coming out that year, Paramount and CBS did virtually nothing to commemorate Trek. Nothing. There was like this one YouTube video, I think the Paramount released, which was some sort of little montage. CBS did something for like a tribute to Trek at the Emmys or something like that. And that was about it. There was no specials. There was no release of any sort of special features or anything like that. Although I have heard that there is apparently a Blu-ray out there now that someone released, which is full of deleted scenes and outtakes from the original series. Ooh. And you can buy it now. It was released around that time, but to no fanfare. I'm kind of curious what's on there. Anyway, somebody tell us if it's any good. I'm not going to trust the Amazon reviews because they're all written by bots.
Right.
But, you know, I think the big question here is, what are we looking at as far as the growth of Trek, as you've said? You know, I know the show is still, you know, I know the show is still creating new fans, but those new fans are being found through existing fans. They're people who are being introduced to it by existing fans. You don't have the exponential growth of somebody tuning in and flipping through the channels and just being, if you, for lack of a better term, ambushed by Trek. The way that, you know, people were discovering TNG because of BBC America and just constantly airing, which is actually, given the fact that Pluto is owned by Paramount Plus, CBS All Access, I'm surprised, and maybe this will change, but maybe as these new Trek series kind of end their shelf life, that rather than keeping them exclusive to Paramount Plus, that Paramount might consider licensing them as liberally as they have the rest of Trek.
That would be the best idea for them to. And again, that's how Trek continued to live during the, you know, the long winter between 1969 and 1979.
Right. So sell it to syndication again.
Yeah, literally put it in syndication. I think that, like, the idea that CBS aired the first few seasons of Discovery, I felt like that was a good idea, but they should have given it the ad push that they would give for any hot show that they air on a Sunday night during family time. And that's the thing. It feels like they're banking on the franchise to bring franchise viewers and not new viewers.
And I would even argue that another opportunity, given the fact that 2020 proved such a wide dearth of television programming that they decided to bring out Discovery on television for season one, why not even consider, at least in the summer waning months between seasons on broadcast TV, that they not air an already released season one time of each of the series. So in other words, drop Lower Decks on Thursday nights on reruns in the summer. So at least at some point, someone can look at it and go, wait a minute, what is this?
And somewhere another lonely teenager who has nothing to do on a Friday night like I was, flips through the channels and discovers Star Trek.
Exactly. I mean, I've got to imagine that's some better use of the properties on television air in the summertime than saying running some totally inane B project from long ago, or just
a game show,
or any of the things that tend to pop up in the summer months, or the fact that they're commissioning another show. You know, the fact that, you know, if CBS wants to cut down the number of shows that they release throughout the year. Now, I know that television is no longer so much the fall to summer cycle that it used to be, but it still does operate by and large on that same cycle. But I just think that if you've already committed to Trek and you've already put it out there and it's completely new and completely fresh, rather than go with that show that you're on the fence about, why not go with the show that, you know, at least it's going to have some bit of a present audience, you know?
Right. There's a pre-existing audience there. Now, I do think we'd be remiss and not fair if we didn't mention that Paramount and the parent company do seem like they are getting better about responding to Trek. Not only do we have a lot of shows coming out, but also there's the announcement that there'll be at least one, if not two, new Trek movies. In addition to that, if not one, if not an additional Trek movie, will be the biography of Gene Roddenberry, something that I think has been a long time coming. I'm intrigued to see who they even attempt to cast for the role, because he's a pretty complex guy. So there is some, I think, bright spots for the future. There's some outlook where I think the fans are going to have a lot to talk about and a lot to discuss. I do hope that they change their model towards getting new fans instead of just appeasing the existing fans and, you know, banking on those fans to have a chain fan reaction. And that's how you bring in new fans. Star Trek has always been an innovator. I hope that we see more of that, because I think that that is what we all sort of gravitate towards.
I second that. And I think this wraps it up for our show. I want to wish everybody a happy Star Trek Day.
Happy Star Trek Day from all of us here at Story Trek. I know we're treating this like Christmas, because for us Trekkers, it is. You can find Story Trek Podcast on anchor.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. And if you'd like to chat, tweet, or talk to your host, you can find us at Story Trek MM on Facebook. That's M as in Michael, M as in Marshall, or on Twitter at @story_Trek.
Thanks again for tuning in this week, and we'll see you soon.
Live long and prosper.